You.
Stew.
De.
De.
Ew.
Ew. Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
Well, don't be sniffy about
I'm not
pens.
Being sniffy.
I think
I'm
you are.
No, no.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
Gay Fantasia on American Themes, or An American Fantasia on Gay Themes.
Playwright Paul Rudnick and New York Times theater critic Jesse Green. Plus,
I thought of a palm chart.
Barry Blitt describes one of his great New Yorker magazine covers. In the studio, I've got screenwriter and off-Broadway comedy playwright Paul Rudnick over here, and Jesse Green, the co-chief theater critic of the New York Times. Jesse wrote an article in the Times headlined, "Will the Old Gay Play Have Something New to Say?" And amid this sudden glut of revivals of gay-themed plays in New York, it was about how gay characters and themes have evolved on the stage and how they do or don't hold up a generation or two or three later. Jesse and Paul, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt.
So we're going to talk about a bunch of the plays, especially from the 80s and 90s that you wrote about, Jesse, in your article. But let's go back. Before there were plays overtly about gayness, there were obviously gay playwrights writing what were certainly since have been regarded as elliptically, cryptically gay plays, like Tennessee Williams' Streetcar Named Desire, or Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, or Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's the first time I remember hearing as a child, like, no, that's really about homosexuals, Kurt.
He will strike you down from the grave.
I know he will. I know he will.
His estate will go after
him. I know he will. So, and Williams didn't like the idea of writing for a gay audience particularly. Either,
that was a less credible position.
Yeah. So Albee objecting to that, Williams not wanting to be considered a gay playwright, was that legitimate? Was it a function of when they were writing both? What?
There was a lot of gay baiting that went on back then because Albee and Tennessee Williams, two of the great iconic American playwrights, were often criticized and accused of disguising gay characters.
At the time.
At the time. And so also, remember, the cost of being openly gay then was unthinkable. They would not have had the careers they had. They would not have had any careers at all.
Were there advantages, do you think, for writers not being able to deal explicitly with gay themes? Was that an interesting constraint in the 1940s and 50s?
I think that's kind of a false perspective because it somehow says, there were more universal themes before people were writing about more marginalized lives. So I think that's kind of unfair. And also, especially in the case of Williams, it was interesting the way he managed to work gay characters, and especially in something like Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, so that they're clearly, these guys did want to write about these topics, but it was forbidden. So I can't think of it as an actual helpful constraint.
I both agree with that and disagree with that, and you're a working playwright, so you should know. But there is a way in which I think all writers thrive under constraints. Any kind of constraint, whether it's word length or how long your play can be or how many sets you have money for in this
production. Or the Nazis occupying Paris. I mean, that is a thing, right?
As a good example. So you could argue that had some of these playwrights been free to say everything they wanted in exactly the form they wanted, they may not have found such fabulous workarounds.
But again, you would have to say, oh, gee, would August Wilson have been better off had he been forced to write about white people? You know,
I think he'd have been better off if he'd been forced to write about gay people. I just think that was his real métier.
I think you're joking.
Yes, I am.
But you see, on radio, like online, deadpan humor doesn't always come across as
noted.
Deadpan humor. So let's move forward in time to the 60s and especially the 80s and 90s. I want to go through a few of these and talk about which ones you like more and less, how they struck you when you first saw them, how well you think they hold up now. And we've got, for many of them, clips from the movie adaptation so the audience can play along at home.
Very good.
So, Boys in the Band, written by Mart Crowley, who's still alive, by the way, and first staged in 1968. Jesse, give the listeners, if you would, a brief synopsis, introduction to this classic.
A bunch of extremely unhappy gay men meet for a party in which they play a devastating game and basically reveal the emptiness and tragedy of gay life. Do you think that's fair, Paul?
It's interesting. I think it is completely valid, but I would also say that my early experience of that play and of the movie, which I thought probably how I first saw it, was probably at like a college film society. I thought of it as far more joyous than that, that I think it is absolutely true that it is a kind of a tragic vision. It's also a very funny play, very smart, and doesn't advocate for the tragic vision. I think by the end of it, it says, no, we have to stop hating ourselves. So that sometimes it gets an unfortunate rap as being anti-gay, which it isn't.
Let's listen to a clip from Boys in the Band.
Hi, darling. Connie Casserole. I'm Mary. Don't ask.
Hello, Emery. Put that in the kitchen.
Okay.
Hello, Emery.
Hey,
how are you?
That's the first?
No, you're not. Lipstick.
Who is this exotic woman over here?
Hi, Emery.
My dear, I thought you'd perished. Where have you been hiding your classically chiseled features?
I don't live in the city anymore. Emery, where's your gift?
Oh, it's arriving later.
Wow. The split between the Straits and the Marys was already so well established.
And by that, we mean what, Jesse?
The straight acting gays and the effeminate acting gays.
That was interesting. I remember seeing it, and it was the first explicitly gay anything I'd ever been aware of.
It terrified me. I saw the movie first, and if I had been out of the closet, it would have scared me back into it. I agree with Paul that it's not endorsing anything anti-gay, but it is presenting such a tragic picture of the current state of affairs, probably fairly accurately
right.
at that, that it wasn't exactly, you know, welcome and rainbow flags.
Right. How did it play to gay audiences and straight audiences at the time in the late 60s and early 70s?
Oh, well, it was an enormous success, both the play and the movie, and they were considered explosive and scandalous, but it was very highly praised and ran for quite a while. So there was a slight sense of a forbidden glimpse at a subculture. On the other hand, because I think it was written by a gay man and written very knowledgeably and wisely, that it wasn't just a lurid peek. There was really a sense of, okay, these lives exist, take a look. So it was a breakthrough, and you can't, I always think that can't be diminished, that I
right.
think Mark Crowley did something that was, especially at the time, incredibly brave. And lastly, because I know it's going to be revived next season, directed by Ryan Murphy, I believe, or at least produced by him.
Directed by Joe Mantello.
Oh, Joe Mantello on Broadway.
Produced by Ryan Murphy.
Exactly. Ryan Murphy, who did direct the HBO version of The Normal Heart, is someone who includes massive amounts of gay, straight characters, you name it.
So, next, let's talk about Harvey Fierstein's Torch Song Trilogy. Paul, you were a fan.
Oh, enormously so. That was it was and is a magnificent play, and it's being given, from everything I've heard, a top-notch revival starring Michael Urie, who is just a world-class actor. And so I think, I remember Harvey starring in it, which was
so did you see it when you were a young man?
I did indeed.
And 1981?
I adored it because— both because it was wonderful to see gay material on stage, but even more so because it's such a terrific play and was so funny and so beautifully performed.
Tell the listeners the basic idea of Torch Song.
Torch Song was, I think, taken somewhat from Harvey's own life. It was about a drag queen making his way in the world and his romantic life, his relationship with a bisexual partner, and ultimately in the third act with his mother, who was not forgiving and not accepting. So it becomes quite explosive by the end. But it was a very wonderfully positive portrait of gay lives and of this outsized, irrepressible, irresistible guy.
Right.
And yet still a portrait of gay lives that were struggling with basic identity questions. This would gradually change so that gay characters could appear without having to argue their right to exist
right.
or to be out of the closet. But at this time, Fierstein really zeroed in on those issues.
I think my biggest problem is being young and beautiful. It's my biggest problem because I've never been young and beautiful. Oh, I've been beautiful. God knows I've been young, but never the twain have met. Not so as anyone would notice anyway. You know, a shrink acquaintance of mine believes this to be the root of my attraction to a class of men most subtly described as old and ugly. I think he's underestimating my wheedles. See, an ugly person who goes after a pretty person gets nothing but trouble. But a pretty person who goes after an ugly person gets at least cab fare. Now, I ain't saying I never fell for a pretty face. But when les gens sont faits, give me a toad with a pot of gold and I'll give you 3 meals a day. Because, honeys, ain't no such thing as a toad when the lights go down. It's either feast or famine. The daylight you gotta watch out for. Well, face it, A thing of beauty is a joy till sunrise.
That is Harvey Fierstein, of course, in the film adaptation of Torch Song Trilogy. Jesse, are you old enough to have seen it when it was playing the first time?
I saw it when it was put together as the trilogy. It had originally been done as a series of one acts off Broadway at La Mama and elsewhere, and then was put together as a one evening, very long event.
Do you expect, and again, being reminded of it from that clip we just watched and heard, that it will hold up and be perfectly relevant in 2017-18?
Oh, absolutely, because I think it was interesting how prescient a lot of, because Harvey in that play just deals with the possibility of gay marriage, gay adoption, how you create a family.
Really?
So, yep. And that play also won the Tony for Best Play, if
I recall. Also, it's so character-based. It's really about
this guy, this entertaining, lovable guy.
And the relationship between him and his mother, which is, you know, will that ever not be topical?
So it seems to me, tell me if I'm completely wrong about this, but that period, that dozen years, are a kind of continental divide in gay culture, gay theater, suddenly out, suddenly the horrors of AIDS. I mean, that was the before and after moment, is that true, fair?
Well, AIDS certainly was the dividing line for many things in gay life, including what happened to gay theater. I mean, of course, using the phrase gay theater or gay plays has, is a problem in itself.
Right.
And often redundant.
Well, perhaps in your case.
You had it in your headline.
I am not responsible for my headline. The way AIDS functioned in the larger questions of gay life, a terrible tragedy that affected pretty much everyone in the community one way or another, but also, sad to say, was the first thing that fully convinced non-gay people that there were real lives worth mourning and treasuring behind, you know, those shadowy figures they had heard about for years. And so through plays about AIDS, the doors came to open for other plays. But at the time we're talking about, that was just beginning to happen with plays like The Normal Heart and Falsettos. And
As Is.
And Jeffrey.
And Jeffrey.
We're next going to Larry Kramer's play The Normal Heart, 1985. Paul.
It was shattering, and it was important on so many levels because at that time in the early years of the AIDS crisis, the media was not covering any of it. There was no source of information. And that
play, it's really early years. It came out in 1985. I mean, the first New York Times article was 1982, I believe.
Exactly. And even that was relatively minor. There was an electricity when you went to see that because nobody knew what was going on. There were certainly no medical answers, and there was no government attention whatsoever. So it was making a difference on so many levels. And I think what, especially the most recent revival revealed, although this was pretty much acknowledged already, it's also a terrific play. It really works. It cooks.
And here is a clip from the film adaptation of The Normal Heart, Mark Ruffalo starring.
I am beginning to think that you and your straight world are our enemy. I am furious with you. And every goddamn doctor who made me feel it was sick to love a man. I am trying to understand why nobody gives a shit that we're dying! $5 million for a house we can't even get 27 cents from the city? I know 43 guys who have died and you say it's my cause, not yours? You still think I'm sick? I simply cannot allow it for one single second longer. I will not speak to you again until you accept me as your equal, your healthy equal, your brother.
One of the signal tones of The Normal Heart is the rage. That represents a perfect meeting of playwright and topic at a particular time, Larry Kramer.
Who was a big, loud activist and remains so.
And founded Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP before being kind of pushed to the sidelines of both of them because of his large personality, shall we say. But in this play, there was no one to push him aside, and he successfully channeled a kind of biblical rage into a dramatic form that still holds up. In fact, I think that's what actually continues to make it viable as a play. Had it been less political, I don't think it would continue to hold up.
And what about the fact that AIDS can now be managed very differently than we had any idea back then that it ever would be or could be? Does that change dramatically the way that that play is watched today?
I find it irritating, to say the least, when people say, oh, it's dated. And I think, first of all, AIDS is still prevalent all over the world, and thank God it's dated to the extent right. it has. And aside from that, the minute you say, oh, a play was set in an earlier age, therefore we should have no interest in it, well, let's erase all of Shakespeare then. But what I've experienced is when younger audiences experience these plays, they've thankfully not had to live through that particular tragedy. But they are fascinated, and it is also historical information for them, and they had no idea.
Because it's like a war movie made during the war.
It is a war movie. That's exactly right.
We're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, talk some more about groundbreaking theater, including, of course, Tony Kushner's Angels in America. That'll be in Act 2 after this brief intermission on Studio 360. I'm in the studio with the playwright Paul Rudnick and the New York Times theater critic Jesse Green. We're talking about some of the best-known gay-themed plays from the 1980s and 90s and how they hold up today. Before the break, we talked about Boys in the Band and Torch Song Trilogy and The Normal Heart. So now let's talk about Tony Kushner's great Angels in America, which appeared in the early 1990s and then in the early aughts became an HBO miniseries. For people who missed it or have forgotten, Paul.
Summarize that, Paul.
Oh, my Lord.
What is Tony Kushner's play about?
Well, all you need to basically know is it's a masterwork. It's one of the truly great American plays, and it's an epic. What was the subtitle that Tony put out?
Gay Fantasia on American themes, or An American Fantasia on Gay Themes.
Yes, because it was set in the age of AIDS with wild flights of fantasy and beyond, that it involves everyone from Roy Cohn to Ethel Rosenberg to the lives of a central gay couple, one of whom is suffering quite terribly from AIDS and the other whom is running away from him. So it's both a very personal story and deeply emotional, and it's about everyone and everything.
I saw an angel weeks ago. I did. I saw her. I did. I'm not insane.
I didn't say you were.
I saw an angel. That's insane.
Well, it's
insane, but I'm not insane. But then why did I do this to myself? Because I have been driven insane by your son and by that lying. Because ever since she arrived, ever since, I have been consumed by this ice-cold razor blade terror that just shouts and shouts, keep moving, run, and I've run myself into the ground. Right where she said I'd eventually be. Really, she seems so real.
That's Justin Kirk and Meryl Streep in Mike Nichols' adaptation of Angels in America. Did you both see the play when it opened on Broadway in 1993?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you couldn't not see it. It really was thrilling. And it was also the introduction of this of the genius that is Tony Kushner, so that you got both the action of the play and also the lyricism and the poetry and the humor, everything else that you thought, oh my God, this is a major writer who's arrived in full flower. So it was beyond an event. I mean, I don't think I can't imagine anything that's equaled it in the years since.
Right.
I had seen an early version of it in San Francisco where it was done at the Eureka Theater, I believe. And it was done on two nights, and I think it ran to about 400 hours. it was not yet cut down to its very modest 8-hour length or whatever it played on Broadway in two evenings. And it wasn't finished, but you knew that something, well, as Paul said, a new voice, new to most of us, had emerged, but also a way of looking at the content that had been bubbling around in a lot of the plays that we'd been talking about, reorganized toward a different purpose and with an enormous vision that went way beyond AIDS and gayness to encompass really the whole
modern history.
Modern history and future history, because looked at now, I find myself very drawn to the part of the story, and amazingly, it's just one part of the story that is about the future of the planet.
So we all agree it's the great play of its era?
Oh, it's that good. Yeah, yeah. I know.
A great gay play, but it's a great American
play. Oh, it is a great
play.
Gay play.
Yeah, it's both. I imagine that Tony Kushner would insist on that as well, but that it certainly is in the canon. You know, when you talk about Death of a Salesman and Streetcar Named Desire, you put Angels in America right up there.
And interestingly, compared to most of the other plays, all the other plays, I guess, we've been talking about, it is not thoroughly realistic. It has these poetic flights of fancy and angels and dead people and so forth. Does that make it less dated?
Yeah, it's not dated in the slightest, because even though a lot of it is a particularly specific attack on Reagan in those years, that doesn't date either when you look at, okay, how do those years inform what's happening right now?
Right. And the central story, which is about betrayal of one character for his lover and his having to figure out how to make his life okay after he betrays his lover, that's another
pretty
story
universal.
That will never, never go away.
Paul.
Yeah.
Let's look at one of your best-known plays previously mentioned, Jeffrey. Here is a clip from the movie.
I mean, look at us. And look at how happy we are. Don't we make you want to fall in love?
Sometimes I think we should be on a brochure for Middle America. Then everyone can say, oh, look, a wholesome gay couple.
Oh, excuse me. You two are not wholesome. You're a decorator. Excuse me, an interior designer. And he's a dancer. You two are like Martha Stewart and Ann Miller. Which, believe me, I prefer. I just hate that gay role models are supposed to be just like straight people. As if even straight people are like that.
That is so true.
Oh, thank God, Paul. Thank God for that play. Really, I remember.
Oh, thank you.
Patrick Stewart and a couple of other actors whose names you probably know.
That was Stephen Weber and Brian Datt. Brian originated that role in the original production.
But Paul, you're interrupting your own compliment.
Go. Keep going.
We had to ID. Go.
Gosh.
You know, in the midst of all these plays we've been talking about, not a one of them a comedy, mind you, and also in the midst of a time of terrible sadness, came a play which was an AIDS comedy, possibly? Can we call it that? I mean, I don't know if you ever called it that, but something that—
It's a genre. Now.
Well, it's a genre of one.
I was going to say.
That really did one of the things that theater can and should do, and it was something no one else was, I want to say, daring to do. I don't know if it felt daring to you, though.
It was only possible because of plays like The Normal Heart, because the subject matter had been treated with the weight that it deserved. But I was a comic writer, and for a while I thought maybe there was no way into this material and into this subject, but I couldn't help myself because all the people around me were so funny. And before there were any medical possibilities, a sense of humor was kind of the only weapon anyone had.
So now, are gay characters being more mainstreamed and the fact that they're gay becoming secondary in plays?
To a certain extent, but I think there's one funny thing that's kind of going on in the theater right at the moment, which is because of gay marriage being legalized, which is a big win for the LGBTQ world, it makes gay people no longer underdogs. And a lot of writers have been wrestling with, okay, we can now write plays about the troubles of gay marriage and gay relationships, which seems a little beside the point after you've had that particular victory. So it's an interesting challenge. But there's still a sense, especially when you leave the coasts, that if you have a play where there's a central gay character, where there is a LGBTQ hero, heroine, you name it, that will still be questionable. That will be seen as a niche item. That, yes, you could still have plenty of gay best friends and gay aunts and uncles, but if it means it, it will still be produced without the frequency of August Osage County, which is a fantastic play. But there could still be marginalized things going on.
But on the other hand, you have the surprising success of a musical like Fun Home, which is the story of a young lesbian discovering her identity. And this is a musical that not only succeeded on Broadway, but is now doing very well on the road. So go figure that one out.
Well, I was just going to ask about that. And I think of the play Indecent. Suddenly you have lesbian stars, characters on Broadway. But only in the last few years. Why such a lag in terms of gender?
Exactly, because also Lisa Krohn, who did the book and lyrics and won Tonys, I think, for both on Fun Home, is a superb writer who had wonderful solo shows and another great play on Broadway called Well that she appeared in. So, yeah, I think there is a lag because I think the culture, also because AIDS was seen as affecting gay men directly. There was a natural output
more
there.
More dramatic.
Yeah.
Do we think if we regathered here in 25 years that we wouldn't look back at this age of the gay play as a kind of specific golden age, that like 1970 to 2000 will be a period of the great gay theater, partly as a result of dealing with AIDS?
Yeah, I think there was a natural flowering that is indisputable, that you often have art in response to a world crisis. And also because the art was very restricted at that time, there were not a lot of movies that dealt with AIDS and no TV shows or very few.
Right.
So that, yeah, that and theater also because it was affecting the theatrical community so immediately. Yeah, I think those plays will be.
And pre and post legal gay marriage seems to me to be a huge cultural thing.
Oh, absolutely.
I think you're right that we will be able to see this discrete portion of time in a certain way. And perhaps what will happen is that gay playwrights, whether or not they're writing about gay characters, will have their work just sort of flowing into the mainstream of all works at that time. And, you know, one day I think you're right, we will look back at this as a time when plays about gay characters flourished because gay people were not flourishing elsewhere.
Jesse Green and Paul Rudnick, this has been deeply illuminating and enlightening and entertaining for me, so thank you both.
Thank you, Kurt.
Thank you. You're a good straight guy.
I do my best. You can judge for yourself how some of these plays we've been talking about stand up decades after they were written. Torch Song has had an off-Broadway revival that's about to end. But then Angels in America begins performances on Broadway in February, and Boys in the Band comes to Broadway in April. You can find out more about all of these productions at our website, pri.org/studio360. That's pri.org/studio360. As Paul and Jesse were just saying, while gay men became more central on stage in big-time theater beginning the last few decades, lesbian characters, not so much. That changed dramatically a couple of years ago, as we were also just saying, with the Broadway run of the terrific musical Fun Home, which won 5 Tonys, including Best Musical. The show was based on a graphic memoir by Alison Bechdel about her own upbringing, growing up as a lesbian in a funeral home in rural Pennsylvania. And that was adapted for the stage by the composer Janine Tesori and the writer Lisa Krohn, who, by the way, were the first female writing team ever to win a Tony for Best Original Score. We'll be hearing from both of them. This is Janine Tesori.
This is going to be changing my major. Just a caveat that I'm a writer who sings-ish, so I will do my best. What happened last night? Are you really here? Joan, 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 Joan. Hi, Joan, don't wake up, Joan. Oh, my God, last night. Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, last night. I got so excited, I was too enthusiastic. Thank you for not laughing. Well, you laughed a little bit at one point when I was touching you and said I might lose consciousness, which you said was adorable, and I just have to trust.
I think the idea of this song was a subset of how I felt and how Lisa felt, and heightened by the sense that what Lisa told me, as a gay woman, that she wasn't afforded an adolescence, that she didn't have that time walking down the hall with a girlfriend or pen and inking notes or hearts into her notebooks. And so what happened was an unbelievably goofy and really hysterical combination of a first time love and romance and sex that has been building and building to this moment, which was, ripe for comedy.
And Joan's crazy brown eyes.
Joan, I feel like Hercules. Oh, God, that sounds ridiculous. Just keep on sleeping through this and I'll work on calming down. So by the time...
Intuitively, both Janine and I felt from the beginning like Fun Home actually would be a good musical, is that I think part of the power of that book is that there's this undercurrent of aching emotion that runs through that book. And it's a story about people who are really checked out and emotionally disconnected, and yet they're just aching with feelings they can't understand or acknowledge or express. And I think music is a way to show people having that exact experience.
Someone just came in the door, like no one I ever saw before. I feel I don't know where you came from. I wish I did. I feel so dumb. I feel...
You know, Lisa's incredibly brave. She has been doing things in theater in downtown for years, and she said, you'll see, you'll see. They can't kiss, you'll see. And I didn't understand what that meant, and what she meant was that they would be laughed at. The audience wouldn't be laughing with them, that they would be laughing at them. And she didn't realize, and I think it's to her great joy, that that's just not the case at all.
I think Fun Home has come to Broadway when there's been this sort of accretion of images of GLBT people, I think, that's been built over decades by artists and by activists and through political change. And I think that it sort of reached this moment where there's enough of a framework there that audiences that a few years ago wouldn't necessarily have been able to, they wouldn't have felt that they could connect or identify with these characters, are having no trouble doing that. If there's anything that I really hope that the success of Fun Home does, is to encourage producers to look at young women playwrights and composers and lyricists and take a chance on them based on their potential.
That's Lisa Krohn, who wrote the book and lyrics for the musical Fun Home. We also heard from Janine Tesori, who composed the music. When Alison Bechdel was in our studio, she talked about what led her back in the early 1980s to launch her comic strip, Dykes to Watch Out For.
I needed to see some kind of reflection of myself. I didn't see in the broader culture any images of women who looked like me or my friends. And I think that we all just really need to see some kind of reflection of ourselves, or something goes a little wrong.
So it's fitting that three decades after she rendered lesbians visible in one medium, in print, somebody else would use her characters to do that in the theater on Broadway. And it has left Bechdel kind of awestruck.
It is extremely surreal and, in this case, very, very wonderful. The play is brilliant. It could easily not have been, you know, it could have been not a good play, but I feel so lucky that they took this really intimate material of my life and stayed very true to it.
That story was produced by Zoe Saunders. Thanks to New York Public Radio and John Schaefer's podcast Soundcheck for the interviews with Lisa Krohn. Alison Bechdel is just one of my favorite diminutive and bespectacled comic artists.
Sometimes you'll do a drawing and that doesn't look enough like Hillary, and you draw it a second time. The second time it looks more like her.
Coming up, New Yorker illustrator Barry Blitt talks about his compulsion to keep redrawing.
But the first time there was some magic or discovery in the actual line work, and it's a better drawing, and that's the one you use.
Why there's more to getting it right than getting just the likeness right. That's next in Studio 360.
Studio 360.
I am a big fan of illustration in magazines, newspapers, wherever. And Barry Blitt is one of my favorite illustrators. When I was editing Spy magazine 25 years ago, I loved commissioning him to create these witty and charming watercolor and ink pictures. And since then, Barry has become one of the main cover artists for The New Yorker. Even though Barry contributed to Spy and I was a New Yorker staff writer for a few years in the 90s, we'd never actually met. Since he's just published a beautiful coffee table book retrospective of his greatest hits, we decided that was a good pretext for finally getting together. Barry's from Canada, but he lives and works in a house in a bucolic little town in northwest Connecticut, about a two-hour drive north of New York City. Turning off the highway, my producers and I drove down this winding dirt road through the woods, and at the top of a little hill is the home of Barry Blitt, which also happens to be the former home, back in the 1950s, of Arthur Miller.
Hello, Barry Blitt. Sure.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Please come in.
Thank you.
Past the kitchen and living room, Barry walked us to the back of his house. This is a beautiful little studio with a big drawing desk that looks, if I were the production designer for a movie about an artist or an illustrator, this is how I would prop it. It looks perfect. I mean,
one can't help that sort of thing, I guess.
And your drawing board is a drawing board, and I see paintbrushes and pens and ink, and on these shelves, just dozens of bottles of inks and paints, or mostly inks?
Inks and watercolors.
Here's an old-fashioned pen with an old-fashioned nib. What do you use?
I prefer old-timey. I use these guys to draw with. These are Croquill pens.
They really are old-timey, so it's just a stick with a metal nib.
That's the technical name for it, yes. Yeah. Stick with nib.
And you dip it in ink.
Yeah, you dip it in ink.
After he finishes with the pen and ink, he usually goes over it in watercolor. And then once that dries, Barry scans it onto his computer and sends it off to the client. But the New Yorker still prefers the old school method. Physical delivery of the actual paper work of art, sometimes fetched by a messenger they dispatch from New York City.
As the New Yorker has asked for more topical stuff, my deadlines have... Sometimes they're only a few hours.
Is that right?
So I can only knock out two or three versions. But, I mean, for a crazy person like me, if I've got 5 days for a deadline or even 2 days for a deadline, I'll draw it as many times as I can. I have sent in like 7 versions of a finished piece.
Really?
Trying it several different ways. But I'm giving them, you know, the same damn thing several times. I could show you some of those.
If we did an analysis of which one works best, which one gets published, yeah. Is it usually a later one or not, or the first one, or is there a pattern?
Oh, it's always the first one.
Making your extra work all the more insane.
Idiotic, yeah. I mean, sometimes it's the second one, but really what you're looking for is life in the line, you know? So sometimes you'll do a drawing and that doesn't look enough like Hillary, and you draw it a second time. The second time it looks more like her, but the first time there was some magic or discovery in the actual line work, and it's a better drawing, and that's the one you use.
Well, I guess if nothing else, you need to do the other ones to prove to yourself that the first one was the best.
Exactly. Huh.
People at the New Yorker often suddenly call you up and say, Barry, this news event happened. Do you have any ideas? Is that how it works?
Well, I mean, I will pitch things without being called, but I think they call a number of artists when something happens and they want it to be featured on the cover, or sometimes there's a mass email that goes out to a great many artists saying it would be really great to do something about Purim or whatever's going on.
Yeah. And you do those beautiful Purim covers for the New Yorker,
right?
Don't you? You reminded me when I walked in here today that back when I was editing this magazine called Spy, we hired you. You did work for us.
I did David Mamet finger puppets.
Yes, you did. One of my favorite all-time things.
Who gets assignments like that? That was fantastic. It was there were several David Mamet scripts that were boiled down, I guess.
There was the not yet great playwright David Ive, who did his versions of essentially Mamet plays boiled down to a minute. And then we said, let's create a whole like little cardboard stage and finger puppets that so theoretically people could cut those out and enact these, and Barry Blitt,
right.
The young Barry Blitt did these.
Right, back when I was alive.
Well, let's look at some of this work. Talk about this.
Okay, well, obviously this has a Spy connection.
All right.
Who came up with short-fingered vulgarian?
It was a joint coinage.
I know, it's got to come from somewhere. Where did it start?
Graydon noticed that his fingers were short while we were starting to do Spy, and he profiled it for a magazine and said, you got to see this guy. Donald Trump. His fingers are tiny for a big guy. And then once we were coming up with epithets, and we went through like a dozen before we hit on short-fingered vulgarian, we said, short-fingered vulgarian. Anyway, so this is a cover, this is a sketch that became a cover for The New Yorker.
Right. It was around the time when that started to rear its head again. I think it was Marco Rubio who mentioned it. And I guess I was trying to think of a way to not just say he has small hands. I thought of a palm chart.
And that's what this is
right.
It's old-fashioned, speaking of old-timey, kind of palmistry readings of the lines on a hand.
Right.
His hand.
You know, on his lifeline, he's saying he's going to live a long time, very healthy. And the line of intellect, you know, extensive, continues on back of hand. So,
which made me laugh out loud. And it's in, as I think listeners will understand, in Donald Trumpian
right, patois language.
Yeah.
It isn't enough, you know, to say he's fat or he...
Orange.
Or orange, right. It's nice to do something with it.
Yeah, no, this was just, it doesn't say Donald Trump anywhere. It's just a hand with stubby fingers and these Trumpian lines explaining his heart line and his...
And your beautiful singing voice. You'd be surprised.
Yeah, exactly. Let's look at the next picture you got here. If I kill you right now, in addition to that story being probably pretty big in the newspapers, your obituary would early on mention this, which is to say this is maybe the most well-known picture you've ever made.
You think I would get an obituary in the Times?
I guarantee it.
Wow. It's almost worth it.
So describe this picture.
This was called The Politics of Fear.
Uh-huh.
I was still listening to Rush Limbaugh at the time, and I was hearing lots of terrorist fist bump.
Summer of 2008.
I mean, there was just so much hatred in the air, it seemed like. And it seemed like a funny way to just draw it all.
And people were saying, oh, Barack Obama is friends with terrorists, meaning Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn.
Right. And at the same time, there was supposedly some...
secret video of Michelle Obama talking about Whitey.
Exactly.
All false, all fantasy.
Right. And I scribbled out something like this, a black and white drawing of it. First, I had Barack Obama as a dressed like, I guess, like a terrorist, like a Muslim terrorist.
And then they're in the Oval Office, and then here's Michelle.
There's Michelle dressed like an Angela Davis type militant, I guess you would say. And there's the American flag.
Well, except I don't know that Angela Davis ever wore an AK-47 and bandolier, which Michelle Obama is doing in this picture.
Probably not. And there's an American flag in the
fireplace.
In the fireplace burning, and there's a Osama bin Laden's photograph or painting hanging in the Oval Office. And there was even a Nazi plate that I had that's come off. Huh. That was there too. I mean, I really wanted to go over the top with this thing. There it is.
The idea being, it was your version of all this crazy caricature of the Obama.
And that seemed to be enough. That seemed to be enough of a joke. It made me laugh. And Françoise Mouly, the art director of The New Yorker. You know, God bless her, was gung-ho. This will put the lie to all this stuff. And to my amazement, you know, I got the go-ahead, you know, and I could hardly believe it. It didn't seem like it was real, that it would actually happen.
Was there any concern by David Remnick or any the other editors there of, this might get us some backlash from the left?
I'm sure there was some of that. This particular one, I remember I brought it. It was so late that I brought it in myself. My son and I went into New York City, and I brought it to the magazine, and Françoise and I walked over to the production department, and the production guy's face, when he looked at it, I mean, he turned white and I did. I expected some kind of backlash, but not as much of it as there was.
No, and the thing is, it's an image that could run on a conservative magazine like the National Review or the Weekly Standard. It would still be a joke, but it would be a joke coming from the right, saying, this is what we think of people.
Context is everything. I mean, Rush Limbaugh had it on his website with himself at an easel.
Oh, really?
Painting it, yeah.
Talk about the reaction.
The reaction was, it was instant. I was high, and I was playing music with a friend on a Sunday evening, and the magazine, I think, goes out to the media on Sunday before it hits the newsstands on Monday. But Sunday evening, I started to get calls and emails about it. Huffington Post was the first. They asked me if I regretted it, and I was, I don't know, it hasn't come out yet. Let me see if I regret it. And then it was just everywhere. My email box filled up at 1,000. I think that's the maximum you can have in AOL. And it was seemed to be all over the world.
You're an AOL guy, by the way?
I am still an AOL guy. I was paying for it
until
a few
blood.
Years ago. I realized you didn't have to pay for it.
Oh, you're cute. You're like thank a you. Really old person.
I am. Thank you.
And that kept going. I mean, there was serious. This became an object of serious conversation in the national discourse. Whether you should have done it, whether the New Yorker should have done it. What does this mean?
It's
and
satire.
I assume you have no regret whatsoever.
Oh, I have regrets about everything.
But not but the regrets this, you're supposed to have, like, I wish I didn't do
this. You know what? My regrets here, I wish the fire in the fireplace was more convincingly rendered. I wish it was drawn a little bit better. Those are my regrets.
Yeah, yeah.
It was an interesting thing to live through.
Yes. What do you listen to as you're working?
I'm a bad piano player.
Wow, and there's a keyboard.
It's a great little Nord Electro, which weighs 15 pounds. You can put it on your back.
Really?
If you wanted to
play it. It's handsome as well. So you play that.
I play that, and it's made listening to music while I work difficult because you hear something and you want to play along with it. So
And I read, I believe in your book, in this glorious new book of yours, that you listen to Rush Limbaugh as well.
It's been a while since I've listened to Rush. But when I first got to the States, it was when he was first on the radio and I'd never
in the late 80s.
Late 80s, and I'd never heard anything like it. I listened to him, and there was Bob Grant I listened to.
I was on the Bob Grant show once.
Were you?
Yeah. He was also, he was a right-wing New York radio guy.
Crazy. Yeah. Was he nice to you? Did he?
Very.
Wow.
Told me I looked like Sylvester Stallone, which wasn't true even then, but yeah. So I guess that was nice.
That's really nice.
Yeah. Well, before we leave your studio to talk in a different venue in your home, play on this Nord Electro 3 something suitable.
So, I'm not sure what's suitable. It's got a nice mellotron sound. It's sort of convincing.
Take me down.
Hey, you want to sing?
No,
you sing?
No. Please
come
not.
On, let's
please
all
not.
Sing. We got everybody to. Yes.
After our little jam session, we took a walk outside toward the woods.
Apparently, Arthur Miller wrote Death of a Salesman in this shack back here.
I would call it not a shack. I would call it a shed.
It's a shed. It's a writing shed. And the lore is that he built it himself with his own hands. He was good at this stuff. He was a mensch. And after he put the last nail into the roof, he brewed himself some coffee and wrote the first act of Death of a Salesman.
He kicked it open, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow. It smells like my mother's salmon cutlets. It
smells like the death of a something in here.
Does it?
No.
No, it's not death.
A few windows and a very, very plain desk built into the corner.
I don't know if this desk was here. I know the electricity wasn't here when Arthur built it.
Do you ever, you never use this except except when there are radio crews here and you show them. Oh, look, Arthur.
I come up here sometimes.
Really?
Sometimes I think if I'm stuck for an idea, maybe it'll
be good. You sit here and...
Yeah, but nothing comes of it. And there's no internet up here, so it's almost useless.
Back inside Barry's house, I saw that he'd taken out the drawing for one of my all-time favorite New Yorker covers. It's Donald Trump. I guess you did this after he was president? Or?
This is a crazy one, sort of. I did it after the Iowa caucus, I think, when he lost unexpectedly to Ted Cruz, and it looked like it was over.
Right.
Any slight whiff of loss with him, it seemed like it was over.
Yes.
And the picture is basically, it started to rain on him, and he's only catching wind of the fact that it's raining. He's got one of his little paws, like palm upward, feeling a drop on it, and his hair... the architecture of his hair has all come down with the slightest bit of rain. He's like a sheepdog and it's covered his face. So it's similar to the hand chart in a way, as I'm, taking a cheap shot at his, his physiognomy or whatever.
His ridiculous hair and architecture being the correct word to describe how that's done each day or each hour, for all I know. It's suddenly his hair is just as it would be if it suddenly were drenched in
there
water.
There probably should be some bald spots here. I think I was a little generous to him.
I loved it. I just love this picture because it's mean, I suppose, but it's not savage. It's still kind of charming. And it's one of those things, your sensibility, your comic sensibility seems to me to be so perfect for the New Yorker because it isn't savage.
Right. I mean, I'm mean to my loved ones,
Well, that's enough.
Somehow on paper, I don't have the guts to do that.
Yeah. Well, I could stay in this lovely house with the lovely Connecticut autumn breezes blowing through for the rest of the evening, but you probably would object to that. So before you kick me out, I'll leave. Barry Blitt, this has been a complete delight. You are have been a hero of mine. It was great to talk to you about your work. Thanks.
Gosh, thank you so much. Sure you don't want to record everything again? I think I could nail it the second time
around.
Okay.
Barry Blitt's new book, Blitt, is now available wherever beautiful, charming, old-timey books are sold. And that's it for this week's episode. Studio 360 is a production of PRI, Public Radio International, in association with Slate. Our executive producer is
Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Our senior editor is
Andrew Adam Newman.
Our technical director is
Louis Mitchell.
Our producers are
Sam Kim,
Skylar Swenson,
Zoe Saunders,
Tommy Bazarian.
Our production assistant is
Claude Gallette.
And I am Kurt Anderson.
You're a good straight guy.
Thanks very much for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we're always going on and on about creativity. In fact, we don't know what we're talking about.
When you start to study it and start to try to figure out what it is and specify its constituents, it becomes more and more and more confusing. Nobody agrees on what it is.
The truth about creativity. That's next time in Studio 360.